You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, very pleased to have back on Labor MP Ingrid Leary. As with last time, she still is the MP for Tyree and the spokesperson for Labor, or the shadow minister for mental health. So, Ingrid, welcome back.
Ah, thank you, Simon. And I have to say that I've had some commentary from some people saying, why are you doing Reality Check Radio? And I have to say the reason is actually because of my relationship with you. We have very different political views, as you would agree with, but we've always had this respectful debate, and it has been based on facts. And I'm a great believer that in freedom of speech based on facts. So I just thought I'd throw that out there, because we can't control the narrative in this day and age when it comes to a lot of things, but we can have respectful debate based on facts, and that's what I hope we do today.
Look, 100%. In fact, you preempted me, and because I was going to say, firstly, actually got some lovely feedback. People were thrilled that we had an MP such as yourself to come on and actually talk around mental health. Others obviously robustly disagreeing, partly because of politics and other matters they're upset about, be it, you know, previous government decisions and so forth. But as I said to people in my feedback to them, it's all about discussion. And you and I know it, and you know it continuing as an MP. It is all about debate, discussion, and we hope through it we learn and grow. So again, great to have you back on. And by the way, you've set a bit of a trend. We've had a number of other MPs on. Damien O'Connor has been on now, for example. We've had quite a few from New Zealand First and Te Pāti Māori. We just got to work on the Nats. They're a bit slow. And you and I might agree on that one. They're a bit slow.
I'll leave that one to you, Simon.
Hey, when we were talking last time, we went very general, and you had said to me, hey, look, we should maybe just narrow down into some very specific areas. And there's so many in the mental health space. But I thought, let's start with our youth mental health. I mean, I'm no expert in this, partly because I'm old. But tell us what you're seeing in the youth mental health space. Is it in crisis? Is it working fine? What's happening?
I think it's commonly accepted across both the mental health sector and society generally that youth are in crisis, that it's a really pressing crisis, that youth can be difficult to reach, and that there is more that needs to be done. If we look at some of the data, like the Public Health Communication Centre did a report in May 2024, and it's got some really telling graphs that start out with the number of youth experiencing high levels of distress in around 2011, 2012 was around the 5% mark. It bumped right up in 2021, 22 to over 20%. It's come down a little bit, but it's still sitting over 20%. So that's a fifth of our youth who are experiencing high levels of mental distress. Some of the questions I would ask is, you know, perhaps awareness of mental well-being has changed, and so perhaps youth are more able to identify what they're experiencing. And so that might be a good thing. But definitely, I think nobody is doubting that youth these days have a lot of stresses, have been through a lot of anxiety through COVID, but also through climate change, through a precarious and dangerous world. That's the perception out there, and certainly in the news media, and they're really grappling with this.
Oh, absolutely, and it's not to take away from the two comments you mentioned around COVID and climate change, but I used to illustrate it when I was talking about young people I saw struggling is, of course, they're going to be more anxious and worried. You know, at one point they were being told there's a virus that's going to kill them and the world's about to burst into flame. Now, I'm being slightly facetious as I said it, but no wonder it's impacting. I mean, when we talk about young people today, is it really that it is the outside factors, because they can't be any less resilient, arguably, than the past? Or do you think there's been some sort of change in how we develop and so forth?
It's a really, really big question. And I do think that it depends how we measure mental well-being. There are lots of ways to measure it, and there's lots of different ways to measure well-being. We know that the four most pressing mental disorders that are impacting on young people are anxiety, depression, ADHD, and eating disorders. If we go back to the question of how we measure it, I think building resilience and measuring resilience is possibly one of the best ways we can do that. And so that, I guess, comes down to what are we doing to make sure that our young people are experiencing no harm, so they're able to get that resilience, but also what are we doing to help them be able to build a level of internal resilience that means that even when things are going badly, they don't lose hope and they don't feel overwhelmed or overcome and make bad choices. And so that means that there has to be a level of, I guess, teaching our kids how to fail, and know that that is part of life. So there's a parenting element, but there is also the context about making sure that the schools we send them to do no harm, that we're not putting them into harmful environments, particularly when we're seeing a lot of polarisation and race issues in our communities at the moment, where there is social inclusion and where they can experience a level of resilience to the online bullying that they face.
So just to pick up on those elements about safety and resilience, particularly of young people, or I'm thinking particularly kids at school, how do we navigate, in your mind, Ingrid, both obviously as a spokesperson but as a parent, that the tension, because we'd want to keep our kids safe, but part of developing resilience is actually putting them under a little bit of pressure, including with ideas they're not so comfortable with. How do we navigate that space?
Yeah, another big question. And I guess a lot of it does come down to parenting. You know, what kind of conversations children are allowed to have at home, whether they are free to explore ideas, whether there are boundaries on what kind of type of messaging that they give is acceptable and not acceptable. That's where they learn a lot of the boundaries. I do think there's also the big question of social determinants in all of this. We know there are really strong links between poverty, financial stress, and mental health stressors. And so not only for children who might be experiencing some of this very directly, such as, you know, through poor nutrition or hunger or not being in a warm house, but also if they've got parents who are stressed or they've got parents who are simply unavailable because they're so busy working or trying to unwind. So one of the things I'm really keen to do in the portfolio is make sure that we don't just have a medicalized model of mental health, but that we really do what we can as a society to recognize that all of these things are interlinked, particularly mental health, and that the solutions need to cut across sectors.
100% on board with you there. I mean, even as we, if you will, segment this discussion around youth, you're dead right. I mean, if mum and dad are beyond stress because of their working conditions, can't pay the mortgage, that's always going to flow into the kids. For example, I mean, it's an incredibly simple example, but it is interconnected. And maybe just particularly one last question, because conscious of your time, it's around that question of devices, another big, big question. Social media now is ubiquitous. And I don't know if you've had time, but I've been quite affected reading something called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. And his basic premise is we regulate the physical world, so don't climb trees, but we don't regulate the online world. So kids have been exposed to things much, much earlier. I mean, I hate the word regulation. You know, I come from the right. But, you know, do we need to regulate into that social space more?
It does feel like we're in cowboy territory currently. And I do think we will look back at this period of time and the non-regulation and say, golly, you know, we should have done more. The data in his book is reflected in the data that I just mentioned earlier around the trajectory of mental distress experienced by young people in New Zealand. And I know that he has data that shows the same trajectory both in the US, Scandinavia, and other parts of the world. So the only commonality really that can be pinned to is the advent of social media. So I do think there's a lot of work to be done in that space. One of the challenges, I think, from a policy and governance level is that we work so much in silos. So I've just been looking at the cancellation of three really big contracts with Oranga Tamariki, the one-stop shops, which many of the young people who have spoken to me have said have been a fantastic intervention for young people to be able to access mild to moderate mental health services in a way that they feel comfortable and that suits what they're about. So it's not necessarily specifically for mental health, but they can go in, there are other services, and then they also get mental health assessment as well. Now, those contracts have sat with Oranga Tamariki providers and they've been cut. So that now comes under the Minister for Children rather than under the new Minister for Mental Health. It makes it really difficult to prosecute in some ways. And my concern is that The government is relying very much on frontline community groups to deliver mental health services. That's a good model because communities know best the issues and the solutions. But it's also very difficult to see how much community funding has been cut because these community groups are funded across different government agencies. And if we look at what has happened, it is, you know, despite the rhetoric, it is frontline cuts to funding. We are seeing community groups that are really strapped for cash, many of whom may fall over. And I'm very concerned that we just won't have the funding to be able to provide the support in the short term. And it is going to push people into mental health crisis. And that's going to cost taxpayers more. And we don't have the specialist workforce to be able to take care for them at the crisis end either.
Well, we talked about interconnectedness earlier. If the providers on the front line are stressed, that can have an impact as well on the services they deliver. And put it simply, my own observations, and you've been in Parliament a long time, when we change the silos or fundings in many different areas, you get really good providers who end up spending enormous amounts of their time chasing the money and not as able to do the service they want to do. So it's, look, important that you've highlighted that. Before we go, is there any other, particularly in the youth space, any other, I don't know, early policy thoughts that you've got that, you know, would really help the sector?
Yeah, I think there's a real desire from everybody in the sector to see cross-party work. I sit on the cross-party mental health group. They did some groundbreaking work under the last parliamentary term around the zero suicide goal. And it is a good way to try and find consensus around some common issues. And so Chloe Shawbuck is the chair. She sat on the committee last time. As a group now, and as a deputy chair, I've been looking at, you know, where can we make a difference? I think there's a feeling in the group, which represents all the parties, that neurodiversity is a good one to start with. It does impact our young people. We've got very powerful messages from them about the level of social exclusion that they experience, and often the lack of education and ability to be able to become contributing and positive and constructive members of society simply by the lack of resource available for them and often the lack of diagnosis. One of the things Chloe and I have been talking about is, you know, where in our system does neurodiversity sit? Actually, technically, it doesn't sit within mental health in the government structure. It sits under disability. Now, yes, if you take the social model of disability, people who experience neurodiversity are disabled by the environment around them. So that does fit. But it's also a heck of a label, and not to cast aspersions on any other type of disability. But, you know, it does present differently. Sometimes people might be on the autistic spectrum or have other diversities. And just finding a place that it sits where it can be recognised and not lumped in with other things that are not quite the same, I think is very important for us to be able to understand the needs and then also respond to them in an appropriate way.
A conversation for another time, but I'm 100% on board of what you're saying there, particularly around the labelling, you know, neurodiverse for personal and wider reasons, aware of it for some people I know, and actually that is quite extraordinary, different, but quite extraordinary. And so, yeah, importantly, how we label that has an impact too, not just on themselves as a person, but their mental health. Ingrid, I am very grateful you've made time and come back on. I look forward to chatting again, but thank you again for everything today and talking us through particularly your views on mental health in the youth space.
Always great to see you, Simon, and thank you to you and your listeners.
And so that was Ingrid Leary, the Labour MP for Tairi and the Shadow Minister for Mental Health.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.